Good morning, everyone. My name is Stephen, and I'm one of the pastors at Granite City Church. I appreciate what, as Mike was praying, he was praying like that we would experience transformation. And I just, as he prayed those words, I was just like, yes, 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 that's what we want for this morning. It's too easy for like a pastor to come up in front of a church and for this just to become a TED talk where we walk away and say, okay, that's kind of interesting. Now, what we long for here is that our lives would be transformed by the Word of God. And we've been diving for the past few weeks, diving deep into one of the greatest sermons ever told. And by the way, it's not a sermon that I ever preach. It's the sermon that Jesus preached called the Sermon on the Mount. And so we're going to continue to go into that because we long to see our lives become more like Jesus, all right? And so Jesus is diving in here, and he's talking about the importance of the law. And here's what he said. This is where we left off last week, and then we'll start moving forward through some of this new stuff today. But last week, here's where we left off. He said, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law," that's like the people who really knew how to do it really well, "unless you're like them, unless you surpass them," he says, "you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, that line should give us a deep sense of pause as we consider what it means to be human beings, right? There is a righteousness, there's a human flourishing at the center of what it means to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, what it means to be truly human. It's a righteousness that actually surpasses that, like, checking off the boxes of religious rule following. And I love the way that Mike Chu shared it with us last week. He said that the law is more than just a list of do's and don'ts that we scroll through like a phone book to pick and choose what we need when we need it, right? This is what we do with the law, right? This is what we do with the Bible. We look at it and we say, okay, this one's good for me, this one maybe not so much, this one's relevant, but this is not relevant. No, the law of the Hebrew Scriptures, the law that Jesus is referring to here, is more akin to really a family history book. It's filled with memories and stories, experiences, wisdom, and more. And all of this was designed to teach the people of Israel, our spiritual ancestors, what it means to be human. And that, by the way, is the essence of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Jesus steps up on that mountain, and he's stepping into his destiny to be the new Moses, a greater Moses, and to show the people a new way, a greater way to be human. But isn't it interesting that he doesn't discount the past, right? He doesn't discount the law. Instead, he leans into the law even more deeply. We talked about this a year ago when we did a sermon series on deconstruction. Jesus actually is functioning here kind of like a deconstructionist. He's deconstructing the broken ways that the keepers of the law have used the law like a religious checklist, and he's pushing us deeper. He's pushing past the surface level that's just about behavior and no more. Right? Now, make no mistake, behavior matters to Jesus a lot. Most of what we see here in chapter 5 is about behavior. But Jesus is pushing people even deeper than the surface level behavior to a deeper righteousness that's not rooted in do's and don'ts, but in love of God and of neighbor. He's calling the people back to the beauty of what humanity is supposed to be. That's the trajectory of this sermon series. That's the trajectory of what we're trying to accomplish this fall, a new way to be human. That's where we're going. I love the line in the song that we just sang earlier, "When every creature finds its inmost melody and every human heart its native cry." Wow. Like, we've been missing what it means to be who we were made to be. And Jesus here is unpacking the law for a new generation. He's deconstructing their misunderstanding, and he's reconstructing it to the beautiful intent that it was supposed to be in the first place. Not throwing out the law, but leaning in more deeply. And one of the reasons that at our church you'll continually hear us lifting up the law, lifting up the Old Testament, just like Jesus did, is because here in our generation, in the church today, we're very quick to dismiss the Old Testament as archaic and out of date. Well, no, actually, we desperately need the Old Testament law. Jesus understood this, and that's why he leans in even more deeply. And for the next few weeks, we're going to get to see Jesus unpack this. And what he does is he uses six different case studies, and we'll look at most of them. And Jesus' list, while not exhaustive, is kind of like a soap opera of human drama and misery. I mean, he looks at laws about lust and the objectification of human beings, particularly women, divorce, oaths, which is basically about manipulation of people. He looks at retaliation. Like, you can't tell me that the Bible is not relevant, right? And Jesus starts off with a bang talking about the most dramatic topic of all, murder, right? And as a culture, we've kind of become obsessed with the intrigue and the drama of true crime stories. When I was in high school, we didn't have like the true crime stories in the same way that we do today, but we had this thing called the O.J. Simpson trial. And when I'll never forget, it was like we were so enraptured by this murder that happened. I recall one day, I think it was the day that the verdict was being released, like an entire day of high school, we flipped on the TVs and we stopped learning for a whole day just to watch this double murder trial. Now, today, 28 years later, true crime podcasts make up nearly 20% of all podcast listeners and revenue. Now, does anybody have, if you have cable, anybody have the Hallmark Channel? Anybody? Okay. My mom has the Hallmark Channel. She loves the Hallmark Channel. On a visit a couple years ago, she kept going on and on about the Hallmark Channel and all this great programming. I know lots of Christmas stuff. You know, that's when everybody wants the Hallmark Channel. But I said, really, Mom, what's your favorite show? And she said, oh, it's called Murder, She Baked. I'm like, it's about a baker who solves murders in her spare time. Okay, well, turns out half the shows on the Hallmark Channel are about solving murder crimes. I asked my mom, I said, Mom, why do you love this channel so much? She said, well, it's because the shows are just so much more wholesome than the other channels. To which Kathleen said, yeah, except for the murder, right? But murder intrigues us, okay? It makes us ask big questions, feel big emotions. We wonder why people do what they do. We hope for justice. Even the Bible itself, towards the very beginning, and we'll get to this in a little bit, chapter 4 of the Bible, it has this just awful domestic murder, you know? And the story continues today, does it not? Just this past week, a 23-year-old woman named Sidney Powell of Akron, Ohio, was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of her mother. Now, there's no need to get into the gratuitous details of the events that happened in March 2020 when she took her mother's life. The headline is tragic enough, right? It makes our stomach turn. It makes our hearts grieve for the brokenness of a mother-daughter relationship that should be close and tender and intimate. It makes us question things like, why would something so evil happen? Why would she do that? Where does that come from? It's no wonder that we have laws that forbid something as vile as murder. A society of people cannot flourish when we take the life of other people. That's not a new thing, by the way. That's been around for a very long time. Even when Jesus was around, it had been around for a very long time. And that's what he says when he begins talking about murder. He says this. He says, you have heard it said to the people long ago. So this has been in the works for a long time. He says, you shall not murder. By the way, he's quoting the Ten Commandments here. This is the sixth commandment. He says, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. All right, so everybody good with that one? You note takers, if you're taking notes, do not murder people. Check, right? You got it. If we read the headline in the news about a daughter who killed her mother, we don't need anybody to tell us that's wrong, right? And for all the people in this room who have lived up to this point without murdering anyone, congratulations, by the way, do you know what we do with our lives? We look at our lives and we say, well, I would never do that. I may not be perfect, but at least I never killed anyone. When we think about murder, we think about murder the same way that people 2,000 years ago who were listening to Jesus thought about murder. Like, I'm not a murderer. I'm a good person. We measure our lives, we measure our righteousness by the do's and the don'ts of the law rather than the heart of the law. And so here's where we see Jesus push us deeper towards the true intent of the law. This is Jesus saying the law is about more than what you do or what you don't do, even though that is really important. But he says, this is about your heart. And look at what he says. He says, you've heard it said to a people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. So Jesus is establishing a pattern here, by the way, that we're going to see in the weeks to come. Jesus is kind of doing that deconstruction thing and reconstruction thing. The pattern is, you've heard it said, but I tell you. Okay? He's tearing down the broken ways that they see and use the law and building it back up the way it was intended to be used and understood. You've heard it said, don't murder. But I tell you that don't even be angry with a brother or sister. Like, this is the new humanity that Jesus is trying to build. If we're to flourish as God's intended people, and as God longed for us to flourish, then it's not good enough for us to just not murder each other, okay? Now, Jesus pushes us to not even be angry, not even hold anger towards one another. Now, can we agree that that kind of loops all of us back into the conversation here, right? Those of us who are like, okay, don't murder, check, I'm good. Like, we're actually back in the mix here now. Because all of us have struggled with anger towards other people. Now, a few textual points that are important for us to try to understand what Jesus is saying here. First of all, Jesus is not saying that anger in and of itself is bad. Even Jesus himself gets angry. We see this throughout the Gospels. And Paul said, in your anger, do not sin. In other words, when you're angry, it's going to happen. Don't sin in your anger. Okay, those instances will come about. There may even be times of justified anger. But be careful, Paul says. It's a thin line. Don't sin in your anger. A friend of mine runs an online course on race and racism and United States history that some of you have actually taken. It's called Justified Anger. Now, most of us would agree that we have the right to be angry at the cancer of racism and the brokenness that has been perpetuated on brothers and sisters of color in our country. That is justified anger. But wow, is there a fine line between justified anger and the festering anger that can turn into hate of a person or entire groups of people. We have to be careful. Now, with that in mind, is Jesus commanding his followers to never be angry? No, he's not. That would actually be impossible for us. Anger is an emotion, it's very real, and of course, as we've just mentioned, sometimes it's a necessity, right? Sometimes we need to be angry. There is justified anger. But Jesus isn't talking about that. Here's where a little understanding of Greek can help us a bit. Greek, unlike English, is what my seminary professor used to call a participle-loving language. And so the word here that's translated as angry is the present passive participle tense. Now, all right, don't check out. Before I lose you, here's why this is important, as it speaks deeply to the problem that Jesus is illustrating. Most of our Bibles have the translation, anyone who is angry towards your brother or sister. All right, Hugh, can we put that up on the screen? Did I put that one there? I might not have that one there. Here it is, okay. Anyone who is angry towards your brother or sister. That's what most of our Bibles have as a translation. A better translation is anyone who is remaining in a state of anger toward your brother or sister, all right? Or maybe anyone who is continuing to be angry, continuing to stay in that state of angry. Now, it sounds a little bit clunky, So our Bibles, our English translations don't usually translate it that way because English doesn't work very fluidly that way. But in doing so, we lose some of the important nuance of what Jesus is trying to say. Jesus is pushing us to understand the brokenness that lies at the root of something as horrific as murder, remaining in a state of anger. Okay? A good paraphrase would be, whoever is nursing a grudge, right, towards your brother or sister. Anybody? Like, who hasn't been there? Most of us have been there, and many of us may be there right now. Perhaps you don't even feel it. Perhaps you can't point to it, but it might flare up at moments when the right buttons get pushed. You might not even realize that you were angry, and then bam, right? Where did that come from? Like, some of us kind of need to pull back the curtain on our own anger, and Jesus is trying to do that for us. If we keep reading in verse 22, it says, again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fires of hell. So raka is quite literally like an Aramaic four-letter word. I mean, it's four letters, and it's kind of like a cuss word, all right? It meant something. It meant something kind of like you stupid piece of bleep, all right? All right, or you dumb F, you know, like, I know, we live in Boston here, okay, people, all right, and first century Palestine was, it didn't sound all that different from Boston, right, does it? Like, in Boston, if you look at somebody cross-eyed, they're like, bleep, bleep, bleepity, bleep, bleep, right? I grew up in the Midwest. It's not like that in the Midwest. So in the Midwest, we have this thing called Midwest nice, okay? That's when, like, somebody else cuts you off when you're driving, and you apologize, like, oops, I'm so sorry about that. Like, last week, I dropped Tyler off at his marching band rehearsal, and I'm starting to, like, live into, like, my East Coast persona. And I started, on my way home, and I made it to that intersection of Squanum and Hancock Street, which is just, like, big intersection in the middle of North Quincy. And right in front of me, a couple cars were exhibiting my biggest pet peeve. Like, we all have those, right? What had happened was two cars had entered into the intersection with no way of escape, right? And so their light turned red, my light turned green, and all of a sudden there was massive gridlock. And I'm like right there, like, I just want to get through this intersection. And in an instant, it happened. Like that bubbling, like, anger that sometimes lies beneath the surface, it popped out. And all I had to do was just kind of lean the palm of my hand into the middle of my steering wheel, like with intent, right? And man, I laid into that horn and let him have it. Now, Kathleen has told me I can never put like a Christian fish on the back of my car. And she's probably right. So when you lean in your horn in a certain way, when you're really angry with someone, it's basically like saying, raka! Okay? It's like just one big Aramaic expletive, right? And you can see where road rage incidents sometimes become, like, they can escalate pretty quickly, because one of the guys who was right there in the middle of the intersection rolled down his window, and I got not one, but two very emphatic gestures from the longest finger on each hand. And so here am I saying raka with my car horn. This guy's saying raka with his favorite fingers. And I was so upset. All right? And since I have like Midwest nice in my DNA, and I'm not particularly good at swearing, I poked my way kind of through the gridlock. And as I'm like passing by him and he's right here, I'm like yelling proper driving etiquette at him like through the window. Which is really not much better than you stupid piece of bleep, right? You don't know how to drive. Congratulations, that's like your completely messed up pastor who clearly has anger issues, and I do. Okay, but pastor, like anger still isn't as bad as murder, right? That's what's so radical about what Jesus is saying about this new way to be human. Jesus is saying that anger that's inside of you, that you might be holding on to in your life, is like murder. And we get a sense of that as he leans into the repercussions of anger. In verse 21, he reminds his listeners that anyone who murders is subject to judgment. Okay? That one, we got that one, right? That makes sense. Okay, if you murder, you should like go before the court and you're subject to judgment. Then look at what it says about the festering anger in our hearts and lashing out with the words of anger. Look at that last line of verse 22. Jesus says, again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. Is subject to judgment. So here's the same idea. And then he goes further. He says, and anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fires of hell. It sounds an awful lot like the consequence for murder. But let's unpack this a bit, particularly this last part about the fire of hell. It's almost impossible for us to read a line like the fire of hell without thinking about images maybe from Dante's Inferno, even if you've never even read that, like old, beautiful work of literature, but crazy, and has shaped the way that we understand what we think about when we think about hell. And it's not from the Bible, right? Those are the images that we're given that sit in our brain when we think about the fire of hell. Or that guy who I've seen like over the past like decades of my life. I go on visits to downtown Boston. I still see the same guy. Like, man, how old must this guy be? He was like the sandwich board like around his thing with the, you know, the big pit down to hell, and there's all kinds of fire coming up, right? You know that. You know the guy. You know the guy. All right? We have these images in our mind. And so we think about images like this, like the one up on the screen. And we often have in mind, oh, we got a picture there somewhere. Oh, no, I didn't put it up. But you guys have that kind of image in your head. And we often have in mind this idea of a God who sends people to hell, right? So bad people get sent to hell. Good people get sent to heaven. Now, I don't want to get into an entire theology of hell. If you're curious about that kind of thing, we can talk about it at another time. And I have no intent to dismantle anyone's theology about judgment. Clearly, Jesus is talking about severity of judgment here, not just for murder, but for anger. But what we do know is that when Jesus says here, they will be in danger of the fire of hell, Jesus is talking about a very real place that the vast majority of his listeners would have known about. What most of our Bibles translate fires of hell literally says fires of Gehenna. Now, outside the walls of Jerusalem, there was a valley called Hinnom. It was called Gehenna in Aramaic. And this was an actual place just outside the walls of Jerusalem, and it's a place that was referred to in the Old Testament. It was the site of some of the darkest, the worst moments in Israel's history when idol worship had reached such a devastating low that children were actually being burned and sacrificed to idols. Look at what we see in 2 Chronicles chapter 28. King Ahaz followed the ways of the kings of Israel and also made idols for worshiping the Baal. So now there's two kingdoms. There's the northern kingdom of Israel, and King Ahaz is the king of the southern kingdom. And the kings of Israel have just been a mess. They've been following idol worship, and now King Ahaz is like, okay, me too. All right? And so he starts worshiping these other gods, the Baals, and burning sacrifices in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. That's Gehenna. That Jesus says. And it says he sacrificed his children in the fire, engaging in detestable practices of the nations of the Lord, that the nations had been around them, that were driven out before the Israelites. That's what King Ahaz did in Gehenna, in this valley of hell, what our Bibles in Matthew call hell. Now, over 100 years later, a prophet comes along named Jeremiah. Jeremiah, unlike a lot of the other priests and other prophets, had not forgotten about this horrific thing that happened. And he wrote about it. He said, they have built the high places of Topheth in the valley of Ben Hinnom, there it is again, the valley of Gehenna, the valley of hell, to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, something I did not command or did not enter my mind. So beware, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the people will no longer call it Topheth or the valley of Ben Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury the dead in Topheth until there is no more room. Then the carcasses of this people will become food for the birds and wild animals, and there will be no one to frighten them away. I will bring an end to the sound of joy and gladness. Oh, think about these images, these words. I'll bring an end to the sound of joy and gladness and to the voices of the bride and bridegroom in the town of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem, and the land will become desolate. Now, let me ask you, does that sound like a pleasant place to exist? So whatever we have in our minds about what hell is, like, just know that these first century people had a very specific idea of what that was, and it comes from this idea of what the Valley of Gehenna is, or what's translated in our Bibles, the Valley of Hell. Now, most scholars believe that by that time, the time of Jesus in Jerusalem, the second temple period, this valley had basically become like a big garbage dump, a cursed place. They would dump their waste over the walls into the valley. They would burn. There's the burning image again. They would burn their garbage there, bones, rotting refuse, other gross stuff. Now, remember, Jesus isn't talking to Americans in 2023. He's talking to people in first century Palestine, people who know the specific place, who know the sordid history, who know the ominous prophecies of that place, and are thinking, when they think about this place, about judgment. And Jesus is bringing this right into their present thought and mind. When we began this series, we reminded everyone of the realities that the kingdom of God is both a future and a present reality. Like, the kingdom is coming and the kingdom is here. Wow. The same is true for God's judgment. God has wired the world to work in such a way that when we fail to live into God's design for humanity, when we choose our way instead of God's way, the judgment isn't just some future arbitrary punishment that is just going to catch up with us eventually, though that is true, but it's more than that. It's a judgment that we live under in the here and now. Scholar N.T. Wright puts it this way: every time, he says, that you decide to let your anger smolder inside of you, you're becoming a little less than fully human. I don't think we realize just how true it is, whatever you think about heaven and hell, that the life to come is a continuation of the trajectory that you're already on in this life. John Mark Comer puts it this way: the reality is that if you don't want to follow the way of Jesus now, you would probably be miserable in the kingdom of heaven, because the kingdom of heaven is where Jesus is king and you are not. So if you don't want to choose the way of Jesus right now, you probably don't want to live the way of Jesus forever, right? Jesus is offering for us a better path for humanity. Let go of your festering anger. It will destroy you, not just for eternity, but starting right now. And so when he comes along and he says that the same judgment for murder is the same judgment that we experience for anger, that his hearers are just going to be like, whoa. And this isn't new, by the way. Like, again, Jesus is always, like, he's just trying to teach people what was God's intent. God has always remained the same. If we go all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, right, it's the same advice that God gave to a man named Cain in chapter 4 of the Bible. Cain and Abel were brothers, just to kind of, like, for those of you who don't know the story or refresh your memory, Cain and Abel were brothers. Abel kept flocks of sheep. Cain raised crops. When they brought their offerings to God, Cain brought his offering, and Abel brought his offering. But Abel brought the very best of his flock, where Cain, it says, he just brought some of his crop, right? And it says in Genesis chapter 4, verse 5, that on Cain and his offering, God did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast, it says. This is what Jesus is talking about. Festering anger, right? So God spoke to Cain. It says, then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. And many of you know what happens next. In his anger, Cain killed Abel. But even before the murder, Cain was in hell. Don't miss what God says here. Sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you. Sin is destroying Cain before the murder even takes place. Immediately after my mini road rage incident up in North Quincy, I was hot, I was angry, and not like the good kind of angry, right? But even as I was feeling those deep, destructive feelings, I was also kind of evaluating those feelings as well. And I didn't like it. I didn't like it. I felt almost sick to my stomach because of the anger. I was in my own personal hell for those, however long it was that I was holding on to those feelings. I felt broken over those thoughts and feelings that I had towards some brother in the city that I didn't even know, in a city that I've prayed over, a city that I've given my last 12 life years of my life to, is to say, I want people in the city to follow Jesus, and here I am like, yeah! Here I was feeling rage and anger towards a person for getting, like, for infringing on my precious right of way. Somebody that is precious to God, who he loves. How messed up is that? But those were moments where the fires of Gehenna, the fires of hell, were very real in my life. Now, if you're like me, those might be rare moments of anger, but there are more common ones that pop up, aren't there? Not with the random driver on the street, or someone maybe in the service industry who's like serving on you but like forgets to bring like the right meal or whatever, who knows. But it's more likely that those moments of anger simmer beneath the surface and they fire up once in a while towards the people that we're closest to. Even as I've been preparing this message, I've been thinking about the people in my life who get a glimpse of the worst of me. My kids, my parents, more often than not, my wife, Kathleen. Like the one person in the whole world that I've actually covenanted with to love is the one person who's most likely to get the defensive response or a snide remark or a contempt of feeling because maybe I felt threatened or small in some way. Like, where does that come from? It's festering anger that gets fed by our insecurities and our shame. And Jesus likens that anger to murder. Sin is crouching at your door, God says. It wants to rule over you. So what do we do? Jesus helps us with a couple pieces of advice. He helps us kind of step out of this, like the false humanity, into a truer, deeper humanity. And I said at the beginning, like what I long for us is that we would experience true, deep transformation. And as you can see, I'm still in process. And I know so many of us are as well. All right, so Jesus had a couple pieces of advice. Both involved what I would call radical reconciliation. In the first example, Jesus talks about the altar. He says, if you're offering a gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Does anybody here, by the way, like think back first century, anybody know where the altar is? Yeah, in the temple. Where's the temple? Jerusalem. Yeah. That is where the altar is. There's not like a bunch of altars. There is a altar, and it's in Jerusalem. Okay? Now, where is Jesus preaching right now? He's in Galilee. He's up on like the side of a mountain in Galilee, like a long ways away, like 3 or 4 days walk to Jerusalem. Think about that for a moment. Jesus is saying that if you're at the altar all the way down in Jerusalem to present your offering, and then you remember that there's a brokenness between you and a brother or sister, leave the offering there in Jerusalem and walk all the way home, whatever the price, Jesus is saying, whatever the cost, whatever the time it's going to take, walk those 60, 70, 80 miles back. Doesn't matter. Jesus is making a powerful statement about the importance of reconciliation. It's costly, clearly. In a few minutes, we're going to take communion together. Right? Like Jesus, Paul urged the Corinthian church not to participate in the Lord's Supper if there was brokenness in their fellowship with one another. Reconciliation is that important. So when you get together, when you participate in that holy meal together, get right with one another. Otherwise, that brokenness is going to fester. You're going to remain in hell. That's not where Jesus wants us to be. He wants us to experience the transformation of living into our true humanity. Get right with each other. You can't, here's the thing. You cannot be right with God and be in broken relationship with a brother or sister. Now, of course, we understand sometimes you may try and try and try and the other person might not reciprocate. But we need to go above and beyond to seek reconciliation because it affects our relationship with God. Your anger can keep you from communion with God. Is that a price worth paying? Years ago, I met a young woman here in our church who simply would not reconcile with her sister, and I pleaded with her to make things right, find reconciliation, bring forgiveness into this relationship, knowing that ultimately her relationship with God would fall apart if she did not seek that reconciliation. And that's exactly what happened. Not only did she not reconcile with her sister, her relationship with God deteriorated and fell apart into nothing. And for the second piece of advice, Jesus uses the illustration of a lawsuit. And the advice here is simply this. Reconcile quickly. Like if you're on the way to court, like on your way, before you even get to the courtroom, reconcile with that person. One thing I tell every couple in marriage counseling, whether they're married or soon to be married, is be very quick to say, I'm sorry. You're never going to regret saying, I'm sorry. Which can be so hard sometimes to make things right. But it's the best advice that you can live into in a marriage or any close relationship. Settle matters quickly. Lay yourself down. You don't need to be right. Worship team, you guys can come on up. I know that I personally have a long way to go with anger that can like bubble up in my life. I need to root that out. It longs to rule over me, God says. It's like a fundamental piece of scripture that goes all the way back. The only way that I've found that heals my soul, my relationships, is earnest, quick reconciliation. I've been, like, this is our 20th year of marriage this year, Kathleen and I. I don't know how we could do it if there wasn't quick reconciliation. Because I've always been this broken. And yet, God has been teaching me, quickly restore relationship. When brokenness occurs, when you say that thing that, it just kind of popped out. Restore relationship. My pride, my need to be right, my time, my emotion, those things need to be laid down, whatever the cost may be. And so, in a moment, we're going to come forward to this table of communion. But I understand, I know that some of you might be harboring just brokenness of relationship. Here's the good news for those of us who are like, man, shoot, I came in here feeling like, good, check, I'm not a murderer, I'm okay. And then you're like, oh, shoot, I'm super messed up. Here's the good news. Here's the good news. Like, one, we're all messed up, okay? So if, by the way, if you're new, like in this church, you're just kind of checking us out, you stepped into a room where there's a bunch of messed up people, okay? So it's not a perfect church. You're not going to find that anywhere. If you do find that church, I'd love to hear about that. You'll probably mess it up if you go there, though, because you're not perfect. But we're all broken. We're all messed up. We all desperately need transformation. But here's the beautiful news. One, God longs to transform us. His Spirit longs to move in us and make us, shape us into new people. And then here's the other amazing news that we remember every time we come to this table is that God longs to forgive us. So for every time that we mess up, we make a mistake over and over again, shoot, why do I keep making that same mistake? Why did I do it again? Why did I do it again? Oh man, I'm working, but oh, this is hard. You can't do it on your own in the first place. You're going to need God. But good news, God's going to forgive you again and again and again and again and again. So we're welcome to this table, but clearly, Jesus says, Paul says, they remind us how desperately important it is for us to make things right whenever possible with brothers and sisters in our life. You have to do it. So before we come forward to this table, I just want us to pause and think about, like, who is it, who in my life that I bear some ill will towards, where that anger just consistently pops up. Hint, it's probably somebody that you're pretty close to, or once were pretty close to. Just take a moment, and I just ask, Holy Spirit, that you would bring to mind in our lives, what are those things that, who are those people that we need to be right with? Jesus, give us the courage, give us the words to know how to move forward, to know how to find rich, deep, quick reconciliation with people in our lives. Transform us, surgically remove that anger from our lives. Teach us how to forgive. Teach us how to seek forgiveness. And show us more deeply what it means to be human with one another. Thank you, Jesus. In your name.